Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz.
And I'm Lahav Harkov.
And we're talking to you as the Operation Guardian of the Walls. Israel's now, we're in our 10th day here, seems to be winding down. We don't yet know if there will be a ceasefire. It seems like a ceasefire is coming, right, Lahav? And the world pressure has mounted on Israel to end this 10-day long operation. But of course, as we know from the past, anything could happen in what's like, it seems like the garbage time, if I were to borrow a metaphor from sports, of this operation.
Yeah, I mean, things seem to be slowing down, both in terms of Hamas rockets on Israel, although they have not stopped, and Israeli strikes in Gaza. And there is a lot of international pressure. You know, the U.S. is standing up to the pressure for Israel, but at the same time is signaling to Israel that, you know, Israel needs to start winding things down. Time to wrap it up. The longer you stay in an operation like this, the more chance there is for you know, something truly catastrophic to happen. Officially, Israel is saying we still have a lot of terrorist targets we want to strike. Last night, we're speaking on Wednesday, so on Tuesday night, the IDF confirmed that they have tried more than once to assassinate Qassam Brigade's commander, Mohammed Dif, and that they're still trying, so that's one of their targets that remain. But the fact that they're sort of admitting that so openly and not censoring it is a little suspicious. I mean, it's obvious that they want to kill Dif. They've tried a million times, and he is missing some limbs and I think is half blind because of those attempts. But the fact that they're sort of saying it openly like that is a little suspicious to me.
Well, I also think, you know, what the IDF is looking for is a victory image, right? And those are always going to be elusive in operations when you're fighting an asymmetric war or asymmetric battle against a terrorist organization like Hamas, which doesn't have clear military designated targets, embeds itself in civilian infrastructure behind human shields and schools, hospitals, apartment buildings, etc. But I also think that, you know, what I'm a little concerned about, and maybe this will maybe be a bit controversial to say, but I'm slightly concerned with what we're claiming to be our big accomplishments here. You know, there's all this talk about the metro, right, which is the underground tunnel network that Hamas has apparently built throughout the Gaza Strip. We know dozens, if not hundreds of kilometers of these tunnels that crisscross Gaza, an underground subterranean city. Israel got intelligence on this over the last few years. They built a lot of it since the last Gaza war in 2014, also known as Protective Edge. And Israel bombed a lot of it, first in the north, then in the south, in Khan Yunis and Rafiah. Impressive, right? Impressive intelligence coup to be able to find the exact pinpoints and access points and the route of this so-called metro. But I mean, let's put it into its proper perspective. Hamas, Islamic Jihad don't have a single surface-to-air missile to endanger our F-15s, F-16s, F-35s that can fly freely over Gaza, right? So this wasn't like, you know, the opening of the Six-Day War when Israel took out the Egyptian and Syrian air forces, right? I mean, this is Hamas, and I have a lot of respect for Hamas.
This is always a problem.
In what they can potentially do, not respect for who they are, but what they could do to us. And we shouldn't, you know, play down the threat of what they can do. They can kill and they can maim and they can cause a lot of damage. But I mean, this isn't like Hezbollah.
You saying that you have a lot of respect for Hamas reminds me of this very viral tweet from years ago that is, you do not under any circumstances have to hand it to ISIS. You know, I don't know if respect is the right word, but I know what you mean.
No, I don't mean respect for them. No, obviously they're terrible. They're genocidal. No, let me rephrase, please. I don't, right. But I have respect for their capabilities of what they can do to us. And clearly they can kill, and they have, and they've killed Israeli civilians and soldiers, and they've caused extensive damage throughout the home front. This is a genocidal terrorist organization that wants to destroy the state of Israel. That needs to be said, and that is the root of this conflict. But
and they've successfully terrorized us, right? Millions of Israelis
for years
in bomb shelters in the past, right? And specifically in the past 10 days, millions were in bomb shelters. Kids are not in school. Most people, if you're able to work from home, you work from home. You know, so for them, that's enough of a victory photo, right? Because for them, they want to show that they have power over us.
And just surviving. Again, they will be the last to fire a rocket, and that will be, you know, that's just surviving this will be their success. But the question that we have to ask ourselves, Lahav, is, okay, if it takes this long against Hamas, if we have such, we have to struggle to find a victory image against Hamas, what are we going to do, God forbid, if one day there is a war against Hezbollah? And I know what people will say. A war against Hezbollah is going to be different because it's going to be so extensive and so many rockets and so many missiles. We're not going to be able to do such these precision strikes with roof knocking and phone calls, warnings beforehand. And we're going to have to go all out and extensive and infrastructure and bridges and power plants and water, whatever, all throughout Lebanon. And that, and that'll be a, you know, far greater devastation. Maybe, but also I just think that Israel struggles oftentimes with these operations. We know how we go in, we have difficulty finding a way out, and then we start to kind of, you know, search for something to cling to hang our hat on and say, you know, this is what we did. So the metro is our big thing now, right?
Which right. none of and us have heard time, of. Last time, what was now. It, like in 2018 or 2019, it was Baha Abu Alata. A Hamas official that hardly anyone had heard of before.
Islamic Jihad.
Right. Sorry. Who, by the way,
Islamic Jihad guy who, you know, was the rank of a brigade commander, right? Like, you know, if you were to compare him to someone in the IDF, not even a general, but he was a guy who terrorized Israel with rocket attacks. Particularly, there were a number that took place while Netanyahu was holding election rallies down south, and those particularly upset the Israeli establishment for the fact that he was able to undermine the prime minister's gatherings while he was down there.
It's a security issue that he's targeting the prime minister, right?
Even if it wasn't an election rally. Without a doubt, and it was good that he was taken out. And, you know, by the way, on a separate note, you know, I think it's just important to note here for a moment, you know, I believe people like to play the numbers game. Israel has dropped hundreds and hundreds of munitions on Gaza over the last 10 days. The number of people who have been killed, even if we go with the Palestinian numbers, which is just a little over 200, Israel claims that 160 at least of them are Hamas and Islamic Jihad. This is the most precise military operation in world history. No one ever has carried out such an accurate aerial assault against an enemy in the world. Israel should be applauded for what it has done and not be criticized for alleged disproportionate response. Not at all. This is, I mean, it's incredible if you think about it in military terms.
Like a proportionate response to Hamas indiscriminately shooting 2,000, I think at this point it's 3,000 even, rockets into Israeli civilian population would be for Israel to shoot indiscriminately 3,000 times. And I don't think anybody wants us to do that. So the whole idea that our response is disproportionate is delusional. I mean, it's like people are living in another planet. They don't know what war is like. But if we get back to things wrapping up, because I think and hope that that's what we're going to see in the coming days, maybe even by the time this podcast comes out, it is a sense that this is just like cyclical, right? Like nobody feels right. Like that's it. Hamas is done. They're not going to fight us again. And even the officials that I've spoken to and I've quoted in my stories, they say, oh, Hamas will be deterred for the next few years. And I think that for so many Israelis, especially those, you know, the million Israelis who live in the south and even in between these wars often have to go into bomb shelters, it's such a disappointment and a real failure. It's a failure of the state to do its basic job of protecting us. And I don't know that I have the answers because Israelis don't want to, for the most part, don't want to go in and have a ground invasion of Gaza or take Gaza back or anything like that. And so it's just a sad state of affairs that it's not clear how this is ever going to end.
Well, I think, Lahav, you know, after the Second Lebanon War in 2006, you know, I remember covering that war and immediately after, towards the end already, writing about the failures and the mistakes and the mishaps, and as the entire press and media was, and Israelis were all talking about the sense of, you know, how we didn't win and it wasn't a decisive victory. And there was the Winograd Commission that was set up, and then there was the IDF different investigative teams to rehabilitate the military. But when you look back now, we're about to be, what is it, 15 years this summer. That's 15 years of quiet, unprecedented quiet along the northern border. So we can't really know now what the what the result will be of Guardian of the Walls, right? It could be that this will last a year, 2 years. It could be that it will last 10 years, right? I mean, we don't fully know what the Hamas calculation is and how much of this extensive damage that Israel has caused Hamas, legitimately so, in Gaza, how much of that will really make them think twice before lighting up the South again with their rockets. So time will tell.
You know, but on a sort of psychological level or a public diplomacy level, like the Palestinian issue, like Israel had managed to sort of clamp it down. And the Palestinians, too, by their own sort of stubbornness, people weren't paying that much attention. And so I wonder if now the world's attention will shift back. Because, you know, COVID is kind of dying down in a lot of places in the world. Not totally, but yeah, right, to an extent. You know, and now
Israelis don't even remember that there was a thing called COVID. Right.
I know. It's like we've been done with that for months. But yeah, so I just wonder if like this is going to be like this big issue on the world stage again. If, you know, the Biden administration, which sort of came in saying, well, there's no chance for a peace treaty anytime soon, so we're not going to push it, is now suddenly going to push it again.
We're going to talk a bit later with Peter Lerner, Lieutenant Colonel, retired Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, who was the IDF international spokesman back during Operation Protective Edge. Served in that role for about 4 years through a 25-year military career, expert kind of on messaging, on the public diplomacy front of Israel. Back then, I think he told me during those 50 days, he did an average of 10 interviews a day, live, you know, stand-up interviews with the foreign press. So like a total of like 500 of them throughout that 50-day operation. We're going to talk to him about the public diplomacy front, how Israel's doing, what has happened, and a bit more about his sense of how this operation is going. But before that, we had a very interesting conversation with Chani Luz. Chani Lahav, right, is a resident of Lod for the last 6 years, originally from New York, moved to Israel just before the Yom Kippur War when she was a child with her family. But the last few weeks, the last 10 days, sorry, in Lod, have seen an uptick in violence that's unprecedented within Israel.
Arabs in the city were sort of marauding and burning down synagogues. You know, luckily most of the fires were put out, but things were severe damage caused, including to people's cars and to people's homes. Large numbers of Jewish families evacuated the city, including a lot of Ethiopian Israelis. There's a big Ethiopian Israeli community in Lod, you know, and in general, it's a poor city. And people have presented this as pushing back against the Garin Torani in Lod. A Garin Torani is, they have these all over the country. Essentially, a group of religious families that comes in and sees a religious community that is dying out or people are moving out, and they want to come in and they want to revive that religious community. And this happens in mixed Jewish Arab cities, but it also happens in places like Ramat Aviv, which is the extremely wealthy North Tel Aviv area, where they say, you know, there are synagogues here, there are religious schools here, we want to keep these communities alive, we want to bring Torah to people's life. So some people don't like these garinim, some people view them as very controversial. But what I think, you know, with this Lod thing, is first of all, the one in Lod has been around for a very, very long time. But the idea is, you know, this impacts not just those, it's not only impacting these people who are sort of ideological. And by the way, the ideology, at least the baseline ideology of a Garin Torani, has nothing to do with Arabs. Like, yes, Lod is a city that's 30% Arab, but I think that this had a lot more to do with just, you know, it's hard to get a minyan, you know, 10 men for the prayers in the synagogues in Lod, and these people wanted to come and revive those communities, and they've been around for at least a decade. But as I said, like, there's a huge Ethiopian Jewish community in Lod. Most of them are pretty poor. It's not a city with a great socioeconomic level, and they too have been impacted and they've had to evacuate. Anyway, but the sites are really scary, and to me, like, it's just such a sad state of affairs when it comes to Jewish-Arab coexistence, because we've had, I would say, about a year now in which things were starting to look really good, both because I think that a lot of Israeli Jews suddenly saw what great partners Israeli Arab doctors and nurses and pharmacists have been in the fight in COVID, and we were sort of all right in this together. And also because of the political situation where both the right and the sort of mixed unity coalition that could have been would have relied on the votes of Ra'am, led by Mansour Abbas, who has taken the truly revolutionary step of saying, okay, I'm going to put national issues, national identity issues aside and focus on civil issues to help my constituents, and therefore I'm more willing to cooperate with Zionist parties.
Well, I think we'll have to see how it plays out, but definitely what's happened is a blow to coexistence. And Khani talks about what it's been like to be there over these last few days with daily riots and fears for people, for their Jewish residents' lives, having to protect their homes, have people come in and, you know, hold nightly patrols. It's interesting. It gets a little emotional, but it's worth listening to get a sense of what's happening to the people, the Jewish residents on the ground in Lod. So now we'll hear from Khani. Khani made a comment during the interview talking about boycotting some Arab businesses. Of course, we at the Jerusalem Post do not condone or support those calls, but it does reflect, I think, on the high emotion and the raw emotion that's now going through the city and the people's residents and the residents of that city, especially the Jews who feel like they're under attack, having synagogues, yeshivas, and their homes burned down, cars, etc. It gives us insight. So, you know, we don't ever, or, you know, sometimes we might agree with what some people say, but this podcast is meant to give people a platform to be able to share their opinions with our readers and listeners. And Khani is one of those opportunities to get better insight into what's happening to the Jewish residents of Lod. So we're privileged to have with us Khani Luz. Khani is a 6-year resident of Lod. She lives in the city together with her husband and 2 children, has worked in the past as a journalist for Mekor Rishon and Hatzofeh, and actually moved to Israel with her parents back in the 1970s, just a month before the Yom Kippur War. So that must have been quite the introduction to the state of Israel. Khani, could you tell us just what's the sense and the atmosphere like in the city over the last week since these unprecedented clashes have been going on between Arabs and Jews? What has it been like to live there with probably this daily fear of what might happen?
Great question. We're living history, unfortunately, a very tragic part of history. Lod was a city that we were coexisting with our Arab neighbors. I can't say that everything was as normal as you would expect, but nothing near what we experienced since last Monday night. We have been complaining ever since I'm here, so that's about 6 years, about the illegal arms that are here. There are dozens or hundreds of illegal arms, and we have shootings at night. Sometimes it's weddings, sometimes it's clashing groups between the Arabs, sometimes it's whatever, underworld crime, but we have it all the time. And we kept on demanding for the police and the government to do something about these arms, because one day it's going to be used against us. And that's what happened on Monday night. Monday night, there was a peaceful, I wouldn't even call it a demonstration. There were people from my neighborhood, my husband and my daughter and others, who went down to the main street, which is a block away from where behind our buildings, okay, around the corner, with Israeli dads, flags. It was Yom Yerushalayim. And they were singing Am Yisrael Chai and Yerushalayim songs. And Arab riders were riding during the day. They were riding in the Old City, which is just a few blocks away from us. It's across the street. The neighborhood is just across the street, a few blocks away. And they started coming. They torched a garbage can, which was on the other side of our buildings. And there were people who were afraid that they were going to throw firebombs towards our buildings and towards our car parking, which I have to say about 5 months ago, 4 months ago, there was an evening that they torched about 20 cars around Lod, but about 9 of them were behind our building. They were just our neighbors' cars, and they looked specifically for Jewish neighborhoods. So that, I'm putting that in parentheses, that was like 5 months ago. So the neighbors were afraid that this is going to happen again. They may throw firebombs into our backyard, and Chas v'Shalom, a fire could break out in someone's house, or the cars could burn. So they went down with whoever had pistols with legal weapons that they have, and went down to guard our homes. And some of them went down to this mini demonstration and singing that we had a block down the block. And suddenly there were dozens of rioters, Arab rioters, who came towards them and started throwing stones and big stones. And they had firebomb in their hand. And they were calling the police for 15 minutes, half an hour, three quarters of an hour. My husband recorded his final phone call to the police, and he says, "We're calling you for 45 minutes, and nobody came. And we're going to use our arms because they're coming towards us. They're throwing stones, and we have this recorded on our video clips. And they were in danger, and they were endangering our homes. And then a few of the men had to use their firearms, and they shot. And one of the violent demonstrators was killed. That's that they found out later that one of them was hurt and he was killed. And then they broke out in a violent rage the next day. This is Tuesday when they had their funeral, and they torched synagogue after synagogue, shul after shul. They went down towards where the old city is, which I'm saying it's maybe 500 meters from my home. And they burnt down shuls, synagogues, and this is mind-boggling. This is center of Israel, and we're seeing scenes that we've seen in other countries in darker ages. We've seen them in Israel in 1929, 1936, and the police were not doing anything. The police were not guarding the synagogues. Not only that, on Wednesday, when they continued burning down Jewish homes and synagogues and businesses, there were guys from one of the shuls that we attend who went down towards the synagogue to guard it and maybe take out the Sifrei Torah, which were very dear to us. And they were arrested. They were taken into the police station for over 4 hours because one of them was holding a stick. And this was going on for about, you know, two nights. And then spontaneously, people from all over the country started to volunteer and say, "We're going to come and guard you." And that's what's been happening ever since, I think it was Tuesday night, Wednesday night. And there were groups who came and started patrolling the streets and giving us more of a sense of security. And I'm saying this, I am happy to see that Am Yisrael are helping each other, but this is a very unfortunate state. This is what the police is supposed to be doing. And when they finally brought in forces of the border police, of Magav, we thought we're going to have quiet. They're going to help keep the quiet on the street. Unfortunately, a lot of their force was aimed against the Jews who came in from other cities to help us. They bussed them. They put them back on buses and sent them back. And they threw, I don't know what they're called in English, the bombs that make a lot of noise, Rimonei Helem. And they were
stun grenades.
Yeah. So they were stun grenades. Okay. So they were thrown at the Jews. And it was an absurd scene to see time after time. Some of them I actually recorded.
I know before you moved to Lod, I read that you had lived in Bet El, which is also can be a dangerous place to live in other ways and has gone through dangerous times. So for you, I guess, what did it feel like? I assume that you thought maybe Lod would be a quieter or safer place. I guess, how is it different from, say, living in Beth El during the Second Intifada, or, you know, how is the feeling living in these?
Right, that's a very interesting issue, because we moved from Beth El. We used to live across the street from the UN UNRWA school, where they were the kids used to come out and riot in the afternoons and then weekends, and it's still going on for about 8 years. They've been rioting every week, at least every week, if not more. And we experienced the shootings. So if you ask me, you know, on a personal basis, I'm sort of, we're sort of used to this kind of atmosphere. Most of the neighborhood are people here who are, they're much younger than us and they hadn't experienced before. And they hadn't lived in those in clashing neighborhoods. Nobody thought that Lod would turn out to be like I felt in Beit El. And in some ways it is. And in some ways it's worse, because these are our streets. They were shooting the people walking around who live here and cross the street into our neighborhood and shoot or set fire onto the cars. And you can't, there's no fences between those Arabs who are violent. You know, not all the Arabs are participating in the violent uprising here. Very few of them are loudly saying stop the violence. And that's unfortunate. the rioters and the incitement that they hear in the mosques, and we hear the recordings. We've been complaining about this incitement for a long time, and these are the fruits of the incitement. Yes, it's similar to what's happening in Beit El, and they're saying it on when they record themselves. They're saying we're part of the Al-Aqsa, we're part of the Palestinian people. This is all the same. The Arabs who live in Lod and Arabs who live in Ramallah.
Honey, the story of Israeli sovereignty, is that what this is? Ultimately, it's a failure by the government for over years. It's not something that's just happening this week with the week of, you know, over the last 10 days or so of violence. It's something that's led up to this point that allowed this to happen was a failure of the police to crack down, to collect weapons, to combat. You mentioned the underworld, or these crime families that have been known for decades to live and control the city of Lod, Arab crime families. Had the government or the police taken action beforehand, do you think that would have made a difference?
Yes, you're wording it exactly. That's the one of the central causes of it is the sovereignty. Yes, and we have to ask ourselves how come the sovereignty is so weak? How come this has been going on for so many years? Yes, our mayor has been begging for police crackdowns and taking the crime families out of Lod, and the fact that when finally the police do arrest and they bring them to court, judges are very easy on releasing them. And there is no, they're not afraid. There is no, how would you say? They're not afraid of the police.
There's no deterrence.
Right. There's not, right. They're not deterred, and they're not afraid to go out. And you should know that the riots on Tuesday were very close to the police station. And the first day they torched one of the smaller police stations, but the central police station of Lod is right across the road from some of these synagogues that were heard, and it's maybe 200 meters down the road. They're not afraid, and this is, yes, it's a wild west what's going on in Lod, and we've been demonstrating and writing about it and talking about it, and people have been in the Knesset talking about it. They're afraid to use the 70 against the violent Arab groups, crime groups, whoever you would call them. And this is the unfortunate result of what's been going on for years. And we're asking, we're pleading the government now, don't ask for a ceasefire now. We're asking them to go in and get these horrible illegal weapons, take them out house by house, go and do whatever you need to do to make order. And you have to have new laws. So yalla, make whatever laws you need to do, because this is the Wild West, and we're living in the center of Israel. We're 50 minutes away from Tel Aviv. We're across the road from used to be called the Lod Airport, and now it's called the Ben Gurion Airport. We're the airport city, and this is happening in the center of Israel. If it happens here, it's going to happen all over the country.
I think it's so shocking and so painful. Is to see, I think it was 8 synagogues that were set on fire and otherwise vandalized and damaged and burned. And it's just shocking to see that happening in Israel, you know, which is like
in the state of the Jewish people. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. We're here so that these things don't happen to us anymore.
Right. And if it would have happened in any European city, the government would condemn it. Diplomatically would condemn what's happening, the anti-Semitism, but this is anti-Semitism here in Lod. Not only that, we're hearing the lies that's been telling them that the Arabs are telling on the media, that we torched the mosques and we were telling everyone to come and torch the mosque. That's a pure lie. There was not one calling to burn down a mosque. They had no damage to any mosque. It's a pure lie. You said 8 synagogues. I think the count here was 10. There were some synagogues that were attacked and the Baruch Hashem were not severely damaged, but there's at least 10 synagogues that we know of that were damaged. And yes, this is a symbol. This is a symbol of the Jewish world. This is our Jewish, what we saw in darker ages and darker times in other countries. This is happening here in our neighborhoods. It's horrific. This is not what we built a Jewish state for.
Well, you had talked about Lod being, for the most part, a place where there was a decent coexistence between Jews and Arabs. Yes, it is a place with a high level of crime, and it always has been, really, I think, throughout Israel's history. But that relatively people could live okay with their neighbors who are of a different religion and ethnicity. Do you think there's any way back now?
I think it's a very good question, and it's not easy. I really think of a lot of my neighbors work in health and healthcare or whatever what's around the healthcare, and they work with a lot of Arabs with them. There are Arab nurses and pharmacies and hospitals. And they've seen that their friends put on their personal status, they put incitement and horrific kind of writing that they it's very hard for them to come back and be their friend. You know, one friend of mine who's a nurse told me that she's afraid to work in the emergency room because there are like only 3 Jews and 20 Arabs, and one of her Arab colleagues actually asked her to substitute him because he wanted to go to the funeral of the guy who was rioting and was killed on Monday night. So it's very sensitive. I don't know how they're going to do it. And our neighbor WhatsApp group, we were just talking about going and to buy in the stores that are owned by Arabs. Nobody had a problem buying in the local local grocery store that's owned by an Arab. And now one of the neighbors said that she talked to the owner and tried to see if he condemned the Arab violence, and he wouldn't. He didn't condemn the Arab violence. And she said, "Listen, neighbors, why are we buying by him if he's part of it? If he's backing it?" And there are many who are saying we're not going to buy by Arabs now, and we're also some of us are afraid to do it. The family that was the one who was killed on Monday night is part of one of the biggest families in Lod, which is one of the biggest problems. He's a very very well known family in Lod. He controls many of the businesses here, the Arab part of Lod. He has Arab businesses, which by the way, he employs only Arabs. I was just thinking back to the store. I went to his store a few times. You only hear Arabic. He used to run the local post office. And they would close on Ramadan because they were all fasting. So I said, how come they don't demand that he employ some Jews so the Jews can open on the Ramadan days? No, you can't tell him to do anything. He employs Arabs. He used to rent he had rental services for affairs, you know, tables and chairs, and the religious shuls used to rent by him. I don't think it's going to continue now. After what happened,
right?
Some services you have to get by Arabs, so you'll get. But of course, we'll be much more cautious about it. It's very hard to rebuild trust after something like this happens, and especially in the neighborhood. I really have pity on the people living in the neighborhood, the Ramat Eshkol, where they're suffering the biggest riots and violence, where dozens of apartments were burnt down and dozens of cars. And these are neighbors of theirs. They were living with them for years. And I really don't know how it's going to go back to be normal after this.
Well, Hani, I want to thank you for joining us. It was good. It was good to have you on. And we hope you and your family stay safe throughout this difficult period that the city is going through. Thank you very much.
Thank you for hosting me. And we call on to the government, make this issue, take the advantage of the time now and get these illegal arms out of the city. Otherwise, we're not going to be quiet. It's just going to be a Band-Aid, a temporary ceasefire. Please do something to get the illegal arms out of the city. Thank you.
Right.
Okay, so now we have our weekly segment, the Tweet of the Week. Before I get into it, I want to remind everyone that you can tweet me, at Lahav Harkov, what you think the next tweet of the week should be. This week we're going to have a serious one, but I do enjoy when we have funny ones, so feel free. Now, this week's tweet of the week comes from the IDF. Last week on Thursday night, the IDF tweeted, IDF air and ground troops are currently attacking in the Gaza Strip. This tweet set off a flurry of reports in the foreign press that ground troops have entered Gaza, whereas the IDF's intention, or what they meant by this tweet, was that our artillery is being shot by the ground troops who shoot the artillery into Gaza. But the foreign press has felt that they were purposely misled and used as a sort of psyop against Hamas, so that Hamas, because what happened in the end is that a lot of Hamas fighters went into that metro, that underground tunnel system, and then Israel bombed them. Our next segment is with Peter Lerner, and we're going to talk more about this extensively.
So it's great to have with us Peter Lerner. I'll just give a disclaimer. Peter's a good friend of mine, but Peter is also a serious professional, gets media, gets the IDF and the relationship between it all. Spent 25 years in uniform in the IDF, and between 2012 and 2017 in his last role, ran in the IDF spokespersons unit, the international media division. So very much understands the way the foreign press operates, the way the military operates with the foreign press. Peter, good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I think it's been a challenging few days for Israel and its public sort of diplomacy, public image in general, as always during these operations, but even more so because of the juxtaposition of two events. First, that the IDF sent a tweet that either intentionally or accidentally, and I'd like to hear your take on it, misled the foreign media to think that there was a ground invasion into Gaza. And then 2 days later, there was this airstrike on a building that had a Hamas intelligence office, but also the headquarters of the Associated Press and Al Jazeera in Gaza. How would you rate, I guess, the IDF's handling of these issues?
So the nature of conflict in Gaza, just because of the density of the situation, means you're always going to have, I would say, about five families of potential crises that can happen. Striking without intention a UN facility, disrupting or destroying ambulances or medical facilities. And the media or a journalist being killed in crossfire is always something that happens. So I would say generally, the military needs to be prepared for all of these scenarios, whether planned or a developing crisis. So what we saw here was actually two different issues. First of all, a tweet, which in my view was a literal translation of the Hebrew announcement, and that went like wildfire around the world, and it took the IDF too long to clarify what they were actually meaning. And that basically framed the situation where the media, the global media, as we've seen in the following days, felt like they were manipulated in order to create a tactical development on the ground to push terrorists underground so that the IDF could take them out.
It wasn't only the tweet. The journalist also called up the IDF spokesperson.
Yeah.
To him, and he confirmed that.
And it took them too long to clarify that there was no ground troop inside Gaza. Again, you know, they took full responsibility and they said it was a mistake. My knowledge of the people managing it and my experience of working within the IDF spokesperson, I generally give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't think that they would intentionally try and manipulate the global media. And if they did, it's a mistake.
Okay, so let's run with that was a mistake. But here's my question, because you've been in you've been in the seat and you've been in these shoes and you know how it operates. I'm curious about the following. There was this mistake with this tweet. There was a mistake maybe with the phone call. This was quickly clarified within a few hours. Let's say it could have been quicker, but within a few hours, it was clarified that there weren't troops who had crossed into Gaza. But then the next day, on Saturday, Israel goes ahead and bombs a media building in Gaza, claiming that Hamas has intelligence and other assets in the building. These are offices of the Associated Press and Al Jazeera, AP being a U.S. organization, large media, probably maybe the largest in the United States. Do you think, from the way these things work, do you think anyone in the Southern Command, in the Shabak, in the Operations Directorate of the IDF, anyone called up the IDF spokesperson's office and said, hey, do you think it's a good time right now to attack a media building? I know at the Foreign Ministry, from what I've heard from people there, no one consulted with them. does anyone, you think, in the military, are they sensitive to these things? Did they think that maybe the timing wouldn't be so good?
Well, you know, the timing obviously wasn't good. But I would say usually the IDF spokesperson is at the table of these decision processes. So the question that needs to be asked is, were they actually at the table when this target was determined? And this is a, you know, the Air Force is conducting these types of strikes. So it's at the general staff level. It's not central. It's not Southern Command. The bank of targets is developed over years. And I can say that I've, you know, this is not a new case that Hamas is taking advantage of media buildings. In 2012, the IDF conducted a targeted strike on a media building where Sky News were located, and they took out the communications capabilities that was on the roof. Again, Hamas taking advantage of media. In 2014, when I was in the midst of Gaza conflict, I got a phone call from journalists saying, please ask your guys not to retaliate because they are firing rockets from outside our building. So this is the framework of how the terrorists operate. They take advantage of the situation intentionally. How the IDF operates within that framework remains the biggest question. And I would say what we have here is actually a terrorist organization that has a media plan supported by a terrorist action plan. So their goal is to create as much footprint of their mission as feasibly possible. So bring in the distress, create the distress, make sure that there are enough journalists to take photos outside the hospitals, make sure that the journalists have access to specific things that cannot video other things. We haven't seen in this conflict launching of rockets. Why is that? We've only seen them from a distance, usually from the Israeli side, because it's being managed on the other side. From the Israeli perspective, you have an operational plan of action, meaning these are the targets, the military targets that we need to take out. And there is a supportive media plan. And there are two sides operating in different modus operandi. They are operating with an operational plan to take out these terrorist capabilities. But the media supplementary needs to be much more robust. The times and days that we are working in of social media needs to realize that if you take out a legal, legit target in a media building, you have to give the information to the media immediately after it's happened. You cannot wait 4 or 5 days later and say we're processing it. It doesn't make any sense from a professional perspective. So this, I would say, that the room for improvement is definitely right. Definitely there. There will be a lot of lessons learned after this case, and it appears that this has been a turning point not necessarily in the coverage, because the coverage is always you know, they're always focused on the civilian casualties, but in perhaps in the sentiment of how things are being conveyed. And that, I think, is what the IDF needs to know how to manage better. Because if you raise an issue, you know, if you want to do it in the best way, you could have informed AP that, you know, there's Hamas terrorists in your building. You need to be aware of that. Now, that's something you need to consider, because that exposes operational and intelligence secrets. But on the other hand, once you've decided that this is something you're going to do and you've evacuated the building, you need to be able to give a very clear-cut explanation conduct a press conference, a briefing, announcement, show the intelligence, show what that needs to be there. The packages of information need to be, you know, people don't take what the military is saying abroad. Now, in Israel, it's a different story. People don't take it for granted. They question everything.
So if I remember correctly, in 2014, there was also a strike on a building that I think was Al Jazeera headquarters at the time. I mean, do you not think that any lessons were learned from then? I guess it didn't make as many waves as this is making at the moment, but it was still something that was, you know, Israel was accused of targeting journalists, etc.
As I said, you know, we were prepared for it, I think, in 2014. As I said, in 2012 it happened, 2014 it also happened. It was what was targeted in 2014 was a meeting place of Palestinian Islamic in the same building that Al Jazeera was positioned. But it was a specific floor in a specific building in a specific room. So it was very, very precision. Here, they took the whole building and erased the building. So there's that's the magnitude of difference.
Well, I think also
back then in explaining it. Yeah.
I think also, you know, because it was the whole building, I mean, I could be wrong. And again, we don't know because they haven't put out the evidence, but this wasn't a ticking bomb, right? This was part of the larger campaign. If you look at this operation, which goes by the bad name of Guardian of the Walls, right, which we need to improve. Peter, get the military to improve the way they call it, the names they use, because this is like, come on. But anyhow,
it's not just that it's a name that sounds bad. It's a name that like suits Hamas's narrative that they're protecting Jerusalem. It's absolutely. Like an extra stupid name.
Absolutely. But you know, when they come up with these names, the primary audience in mind isn't the international audience. So it also resonates to a lot of what Israelis are feeling. You know, I can't go to Jerusalem. I can't, you know, walk around in Jerusalem freely. It's there's always going to be these clashes and tension between the two different audiences. And I'll give you a secret. Every time there is a dilemma, the Israeli audience will always be most important, will be, you know, they are the ace. That is the primary audience of all of the, of all of the Israeli institutions, even the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Just on that point, I wanted to ask you, you know, we've spoken a bit over the last few days about the different theaters of war, right? So there's the battlefield, there's the legal theater, there's public diplomacy, there's the home front, right, where the rockets are landing. And the public diplomacy theater definitely it impacts the battlefield, right? Because what we're seeing now, right, until the AP building, Biden stood completely, it seemed, with Israel. Blinken was not criticizing Israel. That's now changed, right? The narrative and the criticism has only increased since this building was taken down. So the question is, and it ties into what you just said, do the state institutions need to change their focus? Israelis, of course, are going to rally behind their military in a time of war, right? And of course, you want to always work to increase morale. I get that. That's hugely important. And you need to strengthen resilience so they can withstand rocket attacks also, of course. But you also need to have international legitimacy to continue your operation. And if you're not going to be sensitive to what you're going to do when you're taking down an AP office building, then you're going to kill your international legitimacy.
I agree. And I always saw my role as a tool to create the room for legitimate action, legitimate military activities. The IDF spokesperson's unit in the last few years, and I can say it openly because I've said it to Ronen Manelis, who was the IDF spokesperson, has over the last few years taken a slightly different perspective of being another asset in helping the military achieve its operational goals. So much so that I think they're working and operating outside the perimeters of the rules of the game of working with military. And it can be, you know, if you feel that you don't need to give reasoning why you're taking down a media building, then obviously there's something wrong in the thought process. If you feel that it's okay to withhold information for 2 or 3 hours in 2019, we've spoken about this, Jakob, in 2019, withholding information and creating a smoke screen of potentially wounded soldiers on the way to hospital, then what is your job regarding the communication and the faith in the institutions from the Israeli perspective, from the international perspective? I think that the IDF needs to be more attuned to being the bridge to civilians. And being that bridge means sometimes that you can't be the operator of the tactical, operational activities, but you need to be in the strategic position of being that bridge. And this seems that this is where things have gone in the last few years. As an outsider, I'm not operational in the IDF spokesperson's unit. I would also say, though, that, you know, we're talking a lot about the IDF, but I would say that there's no vacuum. The IDF is perhaps a substantial player on the ground, but a public diplomacy effort needs to begin with diplomacy. This is such a huge crisis for the state of Israel. Why isn't the prime minister, the foreign minister, the defense minister banging on the table saying to the IDF, please reveal the information now? Where is the institutions of the state? So either it isn't such a huge crisis that we perhaps as viewers and spectators and analysts and when we watch the media coverage see a perhaps a crisis, but maybe the messages that are being transferred in the diplomatic level aren't as stern as we perhaps receive through the media, through the spectrum of the media, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense. So I think there are some things that we need to take into consideration when viewing media and when reading the media and listening to the media, that sometimes there are a lot of messages that are attuned for public consumption that don't necessarily translate into the direct conversation between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu, for instance. When I read the handout that Biden put out, I thought, you know, it was like in suit for Shavuot. It was milchik. It wasn't a strong condemnation. It noted with concern, you know, diplo talk and giving the you know the things that need to be said, but still acknowledging the fact that Israel has the right to defense. They need to do it in a proportionate manner.
Peter, I have a really important question, though. Knowing you, I don't think you eat milchik on Shavuot, right?
Guilty as charged. I had a nice steak and a hamburger.
Yeah. Okay. No, I was making sure. You got me nervous there for 1 second. I just wanted to make sure that everything is okay. Okay.
I did have a nice cheesecake my wife made.
Okay.
Well, if we're already getting off topic and getting a little silly here, I'm wondering what you think about the IDF's use of social media generally. Right now, during wartime, it's different, but a lot of times they like to use internet memes. They put up things that are very silly and humorous, and I personally have been very critical of it, and I was wondering if you think that that's appropriate.
So this hasn't happened in a vacuum, and we have to keep in mind that social media over the Trump years has transformed into Uber memes. So it's taken a very extreme manner. My perspective, my personal view is that we always need to be calm, collected, reserved to a certain extent. Although there is added value in being humorous and trying to create a wave in social media to get noticed, because you know it is so dense, the playing field, that as Trump proved, the more outrageous you are, the more noticed you get. The IDF needs to be noticed for the good and not for the bad, but they also need to be emotionally appealing. They need to create a sense of togetherness or we're in this together, or we have the same types of problems. So if you combine all of those, I would say it's very hard. You know, all of us here are heavy consumers of social media, and we're very, very focused. And we take one tweet and sometimes we look at it separate from the theme. So I would say, yes, there are issues that I wouldn't approve if I was in charge of it. But I can understand why they are playing this game. In this dense area. I would also say that most of the time, they're also very good in getting information out relatively quick, creating, they put out a very good video today, I don't know if you've seen it yet, about all of the things that Hamas say about Israel. I give you a hint, they haven't said anything good. They're always along the lines of destruction and death of Israel. So there is lots of good content coming out of the IDF, and there are things that I would personally say, you know, let's take the higher road. Let's take the higher road. Let's not stoop down so low, because at the end of the day, you have the brand of the IDF, which is a serious organization that's tasked with defending the state of Israel and sometimes needs to use lethal force. So you can't be a funny guy, definitely not all the time.
Yeah. So Peter, do you think that they'll finally learn the lesson from all of this? Because I don't want to be overly pessimistic, but I think back on, let's say, the 15, 16 years that I've been covering and very closely military affairs. You go back to the Second Lebanon War, you had the incident in Kfar Kana, where it took us almost 12 hours to put out videos of rockets that were being launched from buildings inside that village from the morning when a bomb went off that had been launched the night before and killed dozens of people, innocent civilians. You have the Mavi Marmara, Turkish flotilla in 2010, when Israeli commandos boarded it, got beaten up, were viciously attacked. They fought back, killed a number of them, 8 or 9, if I recall, and only 12 hours later, did they release the video that showed that they were ambushed and attacked just when they came on board. It seems that every single time we don't realize that this, in today's world, this vacuum cannot be left empty. It gets filled by the other side. We have to be, the Israel has to be more sensitive and aware and take these issues into consideration. It seems like, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, it's shame on me. Like, it's just, we're doing this to ourselves. Israel's doing it to itself.
I would agree that in the aftermath of 2006, there was a very extensive inquiry into what they called then the failure of the Israeli Hasbara. One of the outcomes of that war was the need to establish a national information directorate. That directorate has been unmanned for the last 2 years. So I think, you know, if you look at all of the players separately, I think they know what to do, but there is an orchestra conductor missing to conduct and make the music. Now, warfare is always a time of extensive crisis. And the themes and the need to be managed. The access to the media needs to be managed. The initiatives to the media need to be managed. They need to portray the Israeli civilians that are under fire like they've never been before in conflict with Hamas, definitely. And I would argue probably for the last 50 or 60 years, we haven't had such a war on our home front. Those images have been missed. Why is that? So I would say, first of all, the IDF, they are always focused on the operational front, on the attack. But the home front needs to receive its own organization. There needs to be a huge effort in bringing the civilians. Now, I got phone calls saying, Peter, do you know anybody that is an English speaker living on the border with Gaza, living in the area? Somebody should have a list of these people and should be actively distributing it to the media. Now, that's not the IDF's role. So I would say war, as Clausewitz said, is political intercourse by other means. And if it's political intercourse, you need to have a very clear political goal of the outcome of war. The media activities, the public diplomacy activities, the diplomatic efforts, they all need to be in concert. They need to be managed. You know, the IDF spokesperson's unit here is very, very prominent. In other places, around the diplomatic or the democratic world, the military hasn't got such a robust media influence. It's the defense ministry that makes most of the Pentagon. They put out the directive, and everything needs to be attuned to that directive. Here, right. It's much more flexible and much more loose because of the way Israeli society is so intertwined with the military. So I would say if we don't learn the lessons, we will pay prices. All of the lessons have been written down in multiple reports after each and every conflict that we have. And if they want to, it's there for the learning. Unfortunately, I think what happens is everybody gets tied up into internal politics that play a huge part in whatever's happening and most important of the day. And these types of things, they back burner until they happen. I recall before leaving the military, we were constantly in a process of translating materials for a state of war conflict, whether it's with Hamas or with Hezbollah. So identifying the intelligence, identifying the targets, making sure that there is information that translates into why we are striking this specific area, specifically around sensitive zones. This needs to be part of the story, but the entire package needs to reflect on the strategic outcome that Israel wants, not what the tactical victory that the IDF could have in taking out the metro or destroying tactical rocket capabilities by Hamas. Those are all of those successes are supposed to support the political goals.
Peter Lerner, the former IDF international spokesman, 25 years in the military, currently working for the Histadrut Labor Federation in Israel. We thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll see you next week.